2023, and welcome to Discography, the music podcast that delivers the objective truth about the entire discography of every single artist and band that ever existed. I'm your host, Dave Gebro, and in this episode, we proudly feature an interview with the great Don Randy, legendary keysman for the always stunning Wrecking Crew, along with original co-host Joe Kennedy. And if you're tuning in for the first time, I'm over a year into the creation of the show, which has now grown to 3 shows per week, and there's a real audience building. 6-figure downloads in 70 countries, consistently ranked in the top 30 music commentary podcasts, and so now I'm in freefall mode on a serious mission. I've quit my job as a hearing instrument specialist, and if you're listening to this episode close to its premiere date, then my wife, myself, and our 4-year-old are in the midst of driving across the frozen tundra that is currently America to the East Coast so we can live frugally and manageably. And all of that just to ensure that Discography is the standard bearer for all that's awesome about music. So don't go anywhere when this episode's done. Subscribe. Coming up, we have King of Banjo Ambient, Andrew Tuttle raiding the Monks, a soul-bearing interview with Foxygen's Jonathan Rado, episode 1 of the John Landis tapes, Sergio Diaz from Os Mutantes raiding his own early work, and on and on and on, way, way into the future. And all of this while we're plowing 3,000 miles through the snow just so you can rock on uninterrupted in the style to which you become accustomed. Hey guys, throw me a bone here. I need your help. Check out all the back episodes and share the ones you dig with your friends. Go ahead and tag me too. Also, join our Facebook group, Discography, Soldiers of Sound. We're on Instagram and Twitter too, in case you don't mess with the Zuck. Also, please rate the podcast 5 stars, along with a beautifully worded review, especially if you're listening to the show on good old Amazon Music or Spotify, Apple, YouTube, and anywhere else for that matter. It'll help a lot. You can find the link to our legendary playlist in the show notes and also on our website at discography.com. And if you're like me and enough's just never enough, then visit patreon.com/discography and become one of our Patreon Soldiers of Sound. Our Patreon feed is the ultimate music deep dive. I post 3 shows a week. The main show on Sunday, then Discography's The Private Press with Paul Major on Tuesdays, soon to become a television show in 2023, and a Thursday wildcard episode, which is either an interview with that week's guest or one of our other offshoot shows like Rock Cousteau, Queasy Listening, and Battle Royale. So hey, try it for a month, you've got nothing to lose. Okay, back to business. First things first, you need to know just how seriously I take this craziness. Discography is heavily researched, and the music is always reassessed with fresh ears, even the bad stuff. We're not just covering albums. We do a searingly honest deep dive analysis of all EPs, singles, comp tracks, relevant solo work, and bootlegs. Every release is slapped with an objectively accurate star rating between 0 and 5, which allows us all, the real reason we do this, the Tootsie Pop reward at the center of the rock and roll lolly, to come face to face with the true shape of an artist's overall arc. And away we go then, with Don Randy and original co-host Joe Kennedy, as we tickle the ivories of the Imaginarium in our quest for the ultimate objective musical truth. Hey, so we're here in the studio with, man, I gotta tell you, every time I'm in the room with you, it feels like everything's gonna be all right. Ladies and gentlemen, you. Don Randy, the one and only.
Thank you so much.
Welcome to the podcast, Don. Again, I want to thank you for being here too. This is a real treat for us to get to chat with you. And yeah, we actually chat with you every now and then outside of this podcast.
Yes, yeah.
So
I enjoy it because always it's pleasure. Always intelligent questions. What can I tell you?
Right.
Well, let's kick things off. I need to know first off, if you were doing as many as 26 recording dates a week in the 60s, as you talk about in your sure. autobiography, how the hell do you remember everything you've played on?
Well, I remembered most of everything that I played on. There was, you have to remember, many times we would do a session and they didn't even put titles on. So you have to go trace it back, then find out that that's was the title of that song.
Right, so I mean, it seems like just in terms of cataloging this stuff, you'd have to hire somebody to follow you around and take notes for you to even know.
Well, I have a pretty accurate catalog of from 1963 to 1970. And after that, we're fighting with the union right now because they don't want us to go into the archives because of there's a freedom of rights or something, mm-hmm. because everybody's Social Security numbers are on. But who can, we're not going for Social Security numbers. We want to go for the accuracy to be able to collect foreign royalties and stuff like that.
Sure. Did you keep your own personal logs of the sessions? How do you know everything through 70?
There was a guy by the name of Russ Wapinski who was allowed into the union. He really pulled it together for all of us and made us all a lot of money for residuals.
Yeah, I mean, well, and just for fans like us, people who are interested in history, we always want to know who played on what dates. I'm kind of obsessed about that kind of stuff.
Well, plus, if you tell me what date it was, I'll tell you who played on it.
But if you sit down and look at your discography, as you go on, your jaw just drops further and further. So let's do a speed round.
Okay.
Okay. So here's a list of songs you played on. Tell me the and albums.
Okay.
Just tell me the first thing that comes to mind when I mention each of these without thinking about it at all.
Okay.
Zippity doodah.
Phil Spector, Gold Star.
Okay. Anything come to mind with regard to that?
I remember, I think the Sherman Brothers, who wrote many of the Disney things.
Yeah.
I think they were there, and I got to meet them.
I just saw a documentary about them recently. Okay, we're getting outside the speed thing.
Okay.
Okay. Emmett Rhodes, The American Dream. Emmett Rhodes, the avatar of self-recorded bedroom pop.
I do remember absolutely nothing about that.
Okay. Okay. God Only Knows.
One of my favorite Beach Boys songs.
Good Vibrations.
Another one of my favorites.
How many dates do you think you did for just Good Vibrations?
Dates?
How many different sessions? How many times you walk in the door and they're like, okay, it's Good Vibrations
today? At least 20. At least 20, because it took almost 3 months.
As you're doing this, are you thinking this is the sprawling, narcissistic dreams of a madman? Or did you feel like Brian had his shit together, knew exactly what he wanted, but just was exploring?
Exactly what you just said.
Okay.
Many times when you would work with Brian, he had the vocalese in his head and he had to work it out. And he didn't give a shit how long it took because he was going to do it. One of the stories was on Good Vibrations when we had been working 9 hours. And we were all falling asleep on this one section of Good Vibrations. And all I was doing was holding my foot on the low G or B flat of the Hammond B3 organ.
Yeah.
That's all.
Just a little nap, you
know. And I was falling asleep.
Yeah.
I did fall asleep. I laid down with my head on the pedal.
Yeah.
Did you get a sense when you were doing it, like how the edit was going to work and everything at the end?
Or? Absolutely not.
Not. So when you heard the final edit, did it blow your mind?
What interested me was when I saw, I think about, what was it? God knows, someplace in the middle of that, a Thurman player came in.
Uh-huh.
And I said, uh-oh, this is going to go through the roof.
So hold on. So you're working with, I want to deviate from the speed round thing for a second. You're working with Spector. Spector is knocking out these songs live, and then they're done basically in that day. And then you have Brian Wilson, who's taking months for one song. Was there any sense of, has this guy lost the plot, or did you really feel like...
It just two geniuses at work. One does it this way, one does it another way.
Right.
Mind you, Phil took a long time to do one song. Many days, it was all day long.
Right.
The only thing we did that I can remember that Phil did in a hurry, and it wasn't that much enough, was the Christmas album, which turned out to be one of the greatest Christmas albums of all.
Not one of the greatest. It is the greatest Christmas album of all time.
And what an annuity.
Yeah, right.
And what a very clever thing by the gentleman at Sony who made the deal with Phil Spector to grab that as part of the package.
Yeah, if you can write a song that's a Christmas song that catches on, or a song that gets played at sports arenas, you can really do well.
I liken it to inventing Kleenex.
Yeah.
You got to use it and throw it away. And then you got to get it again.
Before we move on from Good Vibrations, do you remember hearing the first time you heard the finished edit?
Oh, I do. I do. I just sat there and went, oh my God.
Yeah. I wasn't born yet when Good Vibrations came out, but it's hard to really imagine.
Kidding.
I'm born in 72.
Oh, so that's amazing.
It's hard to imagine the impact what it must have sounded like when it was new.
It was such a great impact that the whole Pet Sounds album.
Right.
That Capitol,
like even Good Vibrations in particular is even a whole other.
Oh yes, yeah,
a whole other level.
You see, everybody goes after the Good Vibrations one, where God Only Knows is just, as far as I'm concerned, just a great piece of music.
Yeah, the way that song's written, the changes in the melody.
My two favorite albums of all time are Smile is number one, Pet Sounds is number two. you were all over both those records.
Oh, yes, and so was Leon. Leon Russell's on some of them, yeah. Larry Nechtel. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I wish I could say I was the only pianist. It was, you know, that was such a wonderful time because there was about nine of us. And it still wasn't enough.
That so how do you know,
when you look at the credits, it's usually you.
Well,
but how do you know if it's Nechtel on the session as well? How do you know if it's you, Russell, Nechtel?
Can you tell you guys apart?
Most of the times you can. Yeah. But like H.B. Barnum even said, I could get any one of those guys and they'd give me what I wanted.
Right, yeah.
Because we knew where he was going.
That's kind of the task of a session player is, you know, you have to be able to play in a lot of different kind of fields. Well,
you understand being a pianist yourself. Mm-hmm. That, you know, you're the ultimate clone.
Right.
You know,
right.
You're the doctor.
Yeah, you're generating the script of the song.
There you go.
Yeah.
Okay, Broken Arrow. What do you remember about that? First thing that comes to mind.
Neil Young. And my boat trip.
So this is a group that, you know, fragmented.
Don almost got Neil Young eaten by a shark.
I know the story. I know.
I'll never forget it. And he won't.
Yeah, yeah.
Neil. That was the only time Neil was ever milk white.
Okay, he's a rebel. Now we're going back to like serious iconic. What do you remember from that?
That was the start of it.
That was the start of it with
Phil Spector, mm-hmm. with the Crystals, you know.
Yeah.
Onward and Upward.
Do Ron Ron and Then He Kissed Me. Three of the greatest songs ever made. I mean.
And then you have to include Darlene Love and the Blossoms that were the background with the Crystals and took over a lot of the lead stuff on occasion.
Right.
And then, of course, the Ronettes came right after that.
Right. So and that record, The Ronettes, featuring Veronica, is simply one of the greatest albums. Talk about Ronnie, being loaded with good material.
That's Phil Spector, though.
Yeah.
He knew that the talent was there. I think his biggest detriment was that he got tired of the artists he was producing too fast.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
If he had been better at the executive management, he would have hired another producer. Hey, I want you to continue producing the Crystals.
Right.
I'm going to go be doing this one. I want you, now I'm through with the Ronettes, I want you to continue doing the Ronettes.
Like a Bones Howe or something.
Yeah, and now I want you. He had the guy sitting right there playing guitar turn out to be one of the greatest producers, Russ Titelman.
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
Rusty came out. I mean, he could have taken over. Steve Douglas, the saxophone player, became a great producer at Capitol.
I guess people like that, like Phil and his personality, you really got to have his hands on it or else
ego pulls you back from it. Yeah, you have to be able to step aside and look at the whole situation.
Yeah.
But he, you know.
I mean, okay. So just the opening trill on the Jackson 5's ABC, you would be, if you just crawled into that session and never did anything again, you'd be a legend.
Well, that one, you know, that was, I got the call.
Yeah.
I didn't know what it was going to be. And there is this gorgeous little bunch of kids, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And Michael would come sit next to Mr. Randy. Can you show me how to play that? And I'd show him and he'd play it. So get away from it.
Yeah, yeah. Spanish Harlem, another great song.
Sure.
Okay, so Eve of Destruction.
Oh, here you go. Now we're getting into it.
That one was such a huge hit at the time, and you don't really hear it much now.
Number one.
I didn't know the title of the song. I just knew it was Buffalo Springfield, and those guys were coming in, you know.
And he was the Eskimo for the Mamas and Papas. He brought the Mamas and Papas in for a background singing session.
Sure, sure. Who was it? The guy that had the... what was his name? I can't remember his name.
Which guy?
The Eve of Destruction.
Barry McGuire.
Barry.
Yeah, yeah.
He worked my intermissions at a little club called The Losers on the Sunset Strip before it went down to La Cienega. Then it became The Winners after The Losers. And before that, it was Bobby Adler's 881 Club, right at Crescent Heights, just off Crescent Heights and Sunset. Trini Lopez worked my intermissions.
Cool, cool.
Johnny Rivers worked my...
Nice.
And here they all were becoming stars, and I was still getting my jazz sets.
Yeah. only getting the greatest kids in the world. All right. Tell us about your foray into eating pot brownies while working with Laura Nero and Save the Country.
We took a break, and she had baked these wonderful brownies. Earl Palmer was on the date. I forget... some of the other guys.
The song is amazing.
And
such a good song.
So we all had some brownies and had to come back after lunch. You know, that was our dessert for lunch. And everybody came back and just sat there staring at one another. Like, what the hell? And Earl's looking at me. I forget who the producer was. And all of a sudden we heard, you know what, guys? Let's come back tomorrow. and nobody was upset or anything. Okay.
Yeah. We all hippies. that's a really cool song. That would have been really hard to play that on Pot Brownies. It's a lot of like that song's not easy to play.
you know what? People don't realize we would do three different artists in one day sometimes. So we loved if we got to do one artist for 3 days in a row, because we became more a part of that record.
Right.
But
right.
So many times, you know, the especially if you're working for the Warner Brothers, Capitol, Warner Brothers, Reprise, Dot Records, they had a budget. Those were the corporate guys.
Right.
They weren't independent like Brian Wilson or Phil Spector.
Mm-hmm.
Those guys had to bring it in because they had to stay within budget. Otherwise, right. They could get fired. Uh-huh. You know, that was their job. So that's why we did so many so quickly. But we also had to be capable of doing that. There wasn't that many guys that could just.
We were chatting a little bit about before we started recording about the Beatles documentary, and when you watch them try to learn a song, they don't really do it super fast.
No,
they're not like professionals.
No.
In a way, they're guys. You know, they're amazing musicians. They're incredible at what they do.
Sure,
but they're not like, you know, Wrecking Crew where they'll pick a song up in 20 minutes and get a take a half hour later. They got to work it all out kind of painstakingly. You know.
You know, and so many times. The magic of it, you know, which doesn't happen as often today because of the way things are recorded, mm-hmm. but somebody would make the error, the mistake, and who did that? Let's go that direction.
And things have a certain energy to them when you're just discovering them, when you're just getting to the part where you really know the tune, and everybody's still excited, and it's like there's like a magic like little window, like a little golden hour window to really capture it.
And that gives you the memories too.
Now they just fix everything in the computer.
Well, sure, cut and paste.
All right, tell us about Elvis Presley. Tell us about working with Elvis on Little Less Conversation.
Oh, that's great. I love that story because there was no song. if you look at or remember those songs in Elvis's movies, they were horrible.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean,
Clam
maybe
Bank.
1 out of 10, you
yeah.
know.
Yeah.
I mean, but they were.
That's being generous.
Because they would grind them out.
Yeah.
So I forget the name of the movie where Little Less Conversation came from.
It's like a car racer guy or something.
But Billy Strange and Mac Davis were the writers on it. And we had just finished doing something, and the producer of the film or the director was there, and they said, we need one more song. We decided we want to put a song in this thing. And Mac Davis and Billy looked, what do you mean? We need another song. So guys, take a break. The whole band takes a break, and they go out for 10 minutes, and we come back in, take another break, and finally, they have a few chords on a piece of music, a possible lyric, and that's it. And we're all looking out, the band sits down, and we're looking at it, and we kind of do a run-through, and then Hal Blaine says, why don't I just start it with the drum thing, this, and I'll say, I think I'll lay out to this part, and I'll come in here. And we actually made the song, A Little Less Conversation, on the run.
Yeah, you arranged it right there on the spot. Right?
It's done.
Yeah.
And
that's amazing. It's a great song.
The recording's got a lot of attitude to it.
Yeah,
but the people didn't realize, and it didn't happen. It was the only song in that film that ever got any recognition.
Yeah. One of his best songs from that period in general.
Absolutely.
You know, yeah. That one's a real gem.
It was, and it didn't happen till 3 years later, really, mm-hmm. and then it became a giant, and then everybody had it on commercials and on this. The initial date was $165, I think we got paid for that, and over the years, which is a long time now since that movie, I think it must be close to $10,000 all of us got in residuals mounting up over the years,
mm-hmm.
which is really pretty fantastic when you think about that. Hey, listen, you mentioned Good Vibrations and Pet Sounds. When Pet Sounds was done, Capitol put it on a shelf. They didn't know how to handle it.
Yeah, they put out a Best of the Beach Boys.
Best of the Beach Boys.
Which basically means, I guess, you're done.
Yeah, so what are they thinking of? You know, but unfortunately, those are the guys that are in control. They're mostly accountants.
Right.
That never really changed the music business.
No, I don't think so.
That's pretty much exactly the same.
A great story that actually symbolizes how ridiculous the music industry is you became quite well known for your harpsichord solo and different drum.
Yes.
So they wanted you to do a solo album which features no harpsichord at all.
Capitol Records.
Yeah. David, in their infinite wisdom, right?
Thank God for David. David Axelrod. He was the one that pulled that together. That's
so
for sure.
you worked with Kurt Becher, did you not?
I think
on,
so.
On the Association record?
Yeah, sure.
Do you remember working with him?
Kind of, you know. Yeah. I remember more working with Ray Pullman, mm-hmm. who was a guitar player and bass player, who helped them with a lot of the vocalese and putting it together. Ray was
I love
one.
That record.
Oh, it's great.
I love that record. It holds up very well. Also, another one you did around that time, which I've always felt strongly for, is Tim Buckley's Goodbye and Hello.
Now that's close to my heart. Mm-hmm. I love Tim Buckley because I had always heard about someone who could play fit that finger slide that he plays, mm-hmm. and then to watch him do it and to hear the sheer power that it could create instrumentally, man, it just blew me away. I had seen guys do it before, but not the way Tim did it. Tim mm-hmm. did it with such ease, and
his music later got bogged down in some weird attempts at different things.
Yes, those first couple of records,
that
though.
First few records yeah. are amazing.
That was on Elektra, wasn't it? Yes, it was.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. That one's great. You're on Taproot Manuscript. Actually, I could be wrong about this, but one of your first forays into arranging was Cracklin' Rosie.
Oh, yeah.
Or was it your first foray?
No, that was that came way later.
That was in
70. I did a lot of, yes.
Yeah, which was a number one and a fantastic song. how about working
still lightning
with,
rounding? Yes, right?
Yeah, lightning rounding. another artist I love, Mickey Newberry.
Ah, yeah.
Love Mickey Newberry.
Now, you know, I did too, and that's when we did that tribute where we did all those songs, the trilogy.
That, right, which Elvis loved.
That was done at a little studio about the size of this that Elektra had off La Cienega Boulevard. Nobody even knew it was there. I think Bruce Botnick might have been the engineer and
produced. He engineered Forever Changes, which played on.
Yeah.
Do you remember much about those sessions, Forever Changes, and were you aware of Love being kind of the big thing on the Sunset Strip and all that?
Not really, mm-hmm. But because the situation was they were so pretty whacked out
right.
that they hardly were...
Right, they had to bring in you guys to
Yes,
it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, they were on heroin and acid.
Yes.
It's hard to... From what I can ascertain about those two drugs, it'd be pretty hard to function on both of them.
Well, see, records like that where it's, or like the Monkees or Love or some of those Birds record where it's you guys playing it, that just adds to how much I enjoy it. I enjoy it more. Like I have a really soft spot for those Monkees records.
They're amazing.
Because it's like they're really well written songs. They're charismatic singers, and it's all the Wrecking Crew guys playing amazing, like doing their take kind of on the Beatles.
There's three little guys. They were kids.
Yeah.
Dino, Desi, and Billy.
Right. Yeah. Uh-huh. Sure. Right. Same.
They were pushers. Right. You know. They would come in. And poor Billy Hench, he just passed away a couple of years ago.
I did see that.
And he was such a good guy. Yeah. And he had a podcast that mm-hmm. was going on for quite a few years.
Mm-hmm. So Joe and I have had a very soft spot for an album that you did with Nilsson, The Point. I can't believe that's you on Me and My Arrow. Because I've been listening to that forever.
Yeah. You know,
what a great record.
I'm glad you brought that up because I adored Harry Nilsson. Mm-hmm. You know when I adored Harry Nilsson? When he... There was a little deli called the Gaiety Deli on Vine Street. And then next to the Gaiety was Crocker Citizens Bank, where he worked as a teller. Mm-hmm. And then next to that was Wallach's Music City, the famous music store, where everybody went to buy their records. And it was just they had all the listening booths in there. But I remember us sitting one day with Roger Miller, Phil Spector, and Lee Hazelwood, Sonny Bono. We're all having... corned beef sandwiches and the Gaiety, and here comes Harry with his demos on a cassette tape,
nice.
passing them out, mm-hmm. and with his white shirt and his tie on, the short sleeve white shirt. I'll never forget that. It was the first time I met Harry, mm-hmm. and then later on, of course, you know, what a genius.
Yeah, what a voice.
Yeah, he's
but also
incredible.
People missed that whole thing of The Point. Mm-hmm. It never got
good.
You know, it's wonderful.
Yeah.
You know? But that's life, you know. Yeah. You can't.
Well, no, it lives on.
I think people our age kind of it's filtered its way down to us.
It will continue on.
Yeah,
I mean, because the people who care about it, like the two of us,
yeah,
are evangelistic about it.
Yeah, it was an important piece of music. You know?
Yeah.
Just
yeah.
as important as a lot of other things was.
Okay, yeah, speaking of it. Important pieces of music, the last song that I want to throw your way on the speed round.
Yes.
Don't Mean Nothing off the Nancy Sinatra tribute record.
God knows that. That's a hard one to remember.
Okay, there's a reason we brought it up.
Why?
So that was my friend Pete Yorn wrote that song.
Yes.
And Nancy sang on top of his recording, which had me playing piano on it.
Yes.
But they took me off, and they overdubbed you over me.
You're kidding. Yeah. You're kidding. I don't even...
And then they told me. They're like, yeah, Nancy wanted to have Don play on it. I was like, well, you know what? I'm honored.
That wouldn't surprise me.
But then around the same time, I got my revenge because he was making a record called Nightcrawler, and they had brought Leon Russell in to play on some stuff.
Well,
and there was a tune that he just kind of was not getting. It had like a couple of bars of six in it. Like he just wasn't in the mood to do it. So I ended up going over his part.
Oh, that's pretty neat.
Well, that
revenge is a dish best served cold.
You know, there were so many times when you'd get called in for some stupid reason, but you had to. What are you going to? If you don't take the call,
oh sure, yeah.
Then the next guy's going to take the call.
Yeah, yeah.
So what is the record of yours that you play the most to this day?
Of something done from
something that you played on, yeah.
That I've played on, any one of the Spector dates, and Love and Feeling.
Okay.
Love and Feeling gets more play than, you know, and then God Only Knows, you know, and the story with God Only Knows is, in the film, they did a thing, The Making of Pet Sounds, and, you know, there's Brian, and they redid the scene of me and him arguing over how of the passage should go. He had it very legato.
Right.
And it wasn't working.
Uh-huh.
And he kept saying, no, come on, guys, you can play it better. And I kept saying, do it short.
Right.
And he kept saying, no, Don. And you hear the argument. Uh-huh. And finally said, okay. And that was it. And that's how it ended up on the record.
It's also great short because you get that little plinky little delay.
Hey, yes. Yeah. Well, you don't miss anything. Jesus.
So,
You know what's amazing for me? I'm so non-technical my whole life. I always need help when it comes to that. Is how he managed four tracks.
Yeah.
Right.
He was the master of ping-ponging.
Yeah, they would have to do like reduction mixes, they called them then.
And he could... He was already planning that. Okay, I'll put that with that.
Yeah, but the thing is, having those limits makes you have to be creative because you have to plan it out.
You have to commit to things.
Yeah, you have to make commitments. So without the boundlessness.
But that's a great point because Brian could accept that.
Yeah.
I would take me, I'd still be there.
Right.
10 years later trying to do it.
Yeah, now you have like 300 tracks in these Pro Tools files.
It's infinity.
Everyone's got one little string on each channel.
So, conversely, tell me about some records that you feel didn't get the success they deserved.
Oh, boy. there was a lady by the name of Beryl Davis who had an incredible voice. She was one of the Jane Russell, Beryl Davis, and somebody else had a trio. And they'd sing all the lounges. They were unbelievable. And I always thought that she never got the proper break. And she was, I guess, dating somebody who was a producer at Capitol at that point. And Dorsey Burnett, the singer and songwriter, produced her. Hmm. That was one of my first arrangements I did for her. And I always thought she never got the due she could have. I think Darlene Love... As popular as she is, because everybody in the industry knows her, she should have been a monster star after
the Spector records,
She should have done that. What was the name of the guy didn't follow through who did Call Me for A&M Records?
Bill Withers?
No, Call Me. He was on A&M Records. I can't remember. I think Herb Alpert signed him.
Mm-hmm.
But I can't remember his name now. I thought he should have been a monster star. People like, there's so many records that never got heard.
Yeah.
You know, there was a girl that, of all things, Wayne Shuler, who became a producer at Capitol, did for Buck Owens with a girl singer, Betty Swan.
Mm-hmm.
She never got it. You know?
That's with B-E-T-T-Y-E?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
I think so.
you know, you play on so many hits that it's just almost shocking when you hear about something that doesn't do incredibly well that you played on.
Yeah.
So the Wrecking Crew.
Before we move on from that topic, we should put some of those suggestions on a playlist for our fans. Some of Don's picks there. We'll share some of those on our website.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll definitely put some on because there's a playlist that's going to accompany the episode.
Yeah.
Okay, the Wrecking Crew. So at what point, you're doing dates, Steve Douglas brings you in 1962 and introduces you, but at what point do you become aware that you're seeing the exact same faces all the time and that you had just basically joined a gang?
Okay, well, let's start it at the very beginning again. There was no Wrecking Crew. It was called the Wall of Sound for Phil Spector. That's why, got to get those guys. If you make 21 million selling records in a row, who are you going to call? You're going to call those guys. The piano players, if you don't mind, I'm going to list them.
Please.
As many as I can. Myself, Al DeLore, Mike Rubini, a friend of Phil Spector's by the name of Mike Spencer. Later on, right after that, Larry Nechtel, Mike Melvoin, Plas Johnson's brother, Ray Johnson. A guy by the name of Gene, what was his last name? I can't remember his last name, but these were all guys that were studio musicians. I wasn't. I didn't know. None of us really were till Phil Spector. And then we started to do these records, and it started to interchange. A guy by the name of Lincoln Majorca came in later on, a marvelous classical pianist, but he played a lot of rock and roll and a lot of movie dates. Then Joe Sample came out, and Joe played on a lot of dates. So it was building the whole time. But the most amazing thing about it all, there was enough work for all of us.
That's how much
recording was going on.
That's a good point. I think the culture of music in Los Angeles has always been one of sort of cooperation. It doesn't always necessarily feel like hyper-competitive. You know, it's like I feel like I have my colleagues that I know that I work with. I love them all. I'm happy when they're successful. You know, like, it's not like because there's so much of the professional industry is based here. It's not like provincial so much. There's kind of still really kind of enough to go around.
And I always love to say we were interchangeable. And we didn't have time to get angry with one another because we were already on another date, another commercial, a film call, you know.
I think there are a lot of people who are pros here who have that attitude of cooperation. Like, I think even to this day, like, I'm going to go in and make this record sound good.
Yes, sure.
The Wall of Sound is obviously a famous term.
Yes.
Actually, Joe and I are both very curious. We know how it sounds on record. You were in that studio, so what the hell did it sound like?
How did you manage monitoring?
If you took your cans off, what would it have sounded like in that room?
What are you talking? We didn't have cans on.
Okay.
How did you hear yourself like playing piano?
You just heard yourself, you know, and that was it. We didn't put on. Gold Star couldn't afford to buy as many earphones. You got to remember, there was five guitar players also.
That's kind of my point. I think there's five guys playing through amps. There's a drummer and
It was the magic of Gold Star.
Right.
Nobody had an echo chamber like Gold Star. And if you ever looked at it, you'd throw up. I mean, it was,
So were you able to hear what Phil heard in that room, or was it later that when you heard the playback where it
you
really
could have a
focus?
Good idea of what he wanted? But till you heard it inside, you got to remember that was mono, one track.
Right. So where you're sitting in the room is how it's going to sound like to you.
Sure. Right.
Okay.
And also, I think everybody played conducively to each other. You got to remember, you would have percussion, one drummer.
I guess you have to make your own sense of dynamics, right?
How did he get two bass players? Nobody used two bass players.
Right.
An upright and a Fender.
Right.
Because he wanted that wide sound.
Mm-hmm. Chuck Berghofer.
Harvey Newmark, who was in my band, he loved Harvey. And Putter Smith is another one. He'd use those guys because they knew what to give him.
We do have a little list, though, of some Wrecking Crew guys who I feel like maybe don't get their due.
Sure.
You know, Chuck Berghofer was one that we just mentioned.
Yes.
Al Casey. We're talking about Al Casey.
Al Casey was an amazing guitar player. And
sometimes it's hard to pick out who's the guitar player.
I'll tell you a fun story on... was it Something Stupid?
The nylon guitar.
Yeah, so they had finished doing a date, and then Nancy says, we're going to do a song, and she brought in her guys. Well, Glenn Campbell and Al Casey were guys that worked for Nancy with Lee Hazelwood. And Glenn doesn't read. You know, Glenn's, he'll learn it as faster than anyway. So they started, and Frank Sinatra says, that's not the intro I heard, you know. And Al Casey very sheepishly said to Glenn, you know, I played it on the original. He says, do you want me to do it? And Glenn says, sure. So that's Al Casey that plays that. Everybody thinks it's Glenn.
Right. It sounds like Glenn, but
it's Al Casey. Yeah. But Al Casey was a marvelous, great, not only country player, he could play anything. Mm-hmm. He was great. He was a good friend of mine. And he had a shop on Vine Street. He decided to open a guitar shop right near Vine and Santa Monica, in a little shopping mall there that everybody went to there before all the other stores opened up, him and his wife.
How about Bill Pittman?
Oh, marvelous guitar player. Bill was just 101.
Wow.
Yeah, just turned 101. We went to we had a big blast at his 100th birthday last year. But he was one of the five. Tommy Tedesco, Bill Pittman, Howard Roberts. Howard was
he was on my list as well.
Yeah, Howard walked out on a date, he said. Mm-hmm. He told Phil, he says, I can't play this anymore. My hands are cramping up.
We were just playing him before you got here.
You know, he says, you come in and play it, you know.
Yeah.
And he picked up his little Fender amp and left. That was it.
And Jerry Scheff.
Jerry was a marvelous bass player. Incredible. And we did an album that nobody even knows about, including you guys.
Try us.
Okay, what was the hit that Larry Carlton had? Let's work backwards.
Larry Carlton's solo.
Sleepwalk. He had a big hit on Sleepwalk. Okay. But who had it before Larry Carlton?
It was Santo and Johnny.
You got it. That's who we got to do an album with.
Nice. Love their stuff.
Jerry Scheff and I think Jackie Mills might have been the producer.
It's so dreamy. I just love that.
It was great.
Is it the lap steel? Is that what they have?
You know what? I don't remember.
It almost sounds like they almost make the guitar sound like a theremin.
And it's very dreamy. It is. It's very, they came over. They brought them over from Italy, and we were in a little studio for a week. And I never heard the album after that. And I always wondered about it. Jerry Scheff told me years later that he had gotten one.
So I this morning I was reading about this band that was put together by session guys, Clem Cattini, a few other dudes called Ugly Custard back in 1970. There was also Toto, Rhinoceros was one in the late 60s, and Led Zeppelin. These are session guys who decided, you know what? Fuck this, hiding behind the curtain. We want to be superstars. How do you feel about that kind of methodology?
Well, one of my favorite all-time bands is Toto.
Is it? Yeah.
Because they started at the Baked Potato.
Had you ever thought about doing that or no?
Well, we all do. I don't care how many sessions you've done. Everybody would have to love to have that moment in the spotlight, you know, and to be out front. You know, fortunately, I've had those opportunities, and I adore them and love them, and they're part of my life.
I'm more a natural-born sideman. I like being in the front.
Yeah.
Some people. I had a marvelous bass player with us, Ed Alton. He does a lot of TV writing, and he's a marvelous musician. And Marcus Miller comes in one night at the club and decides to sit in. And, you know, he's a monster. Monster bass player, monster musician. And Alton wouldn't come back. Marcus and I could go home. He says, I'm not coming playing. Not after that. I'm not playing. He ended up having to work the whole night. Well, he would not play. You know, it's delightful, but it happens, you know. I've also watched musicians destroy themselves, you know, because of things that they would say. And not realizing that what they're saying is hurtful.
That's a big part of the whole thing of staying a working musician is just being cool.
That's
a big part of it.
You have to know when to lay out, so to speak.
Yeah,
you know?
Right. And playing is and more. In life.
You know, one of my favorite stories in your book was you explaining Phil Spector's methodology about the A side and the F side. Can you please lay that out? Because I think that's kind of genius.
Well, Phil Spector would put out a single record, not from the LP. When the single came out, that's what the airplay was based on. So he didn't want them to play what was ever on the backside of that record, so he'd make the worst-sounding records, or he'd put an instrumental on that wasn't so worst-sounding, but it didn't have any lyrics to it.
No chance of being on the radio, right.
No chance that...
You were responsible for putting some of the direct
absolutely.
Together, right?
Oh, yeah. The backside to Love and Feeling is there is an old woman who plays piano in his bar, and Billy, Bobby, and I wrote that. We didn't get credit for writing it. But what can I tell you?
Thank God, right?
But two stations down south went on the B-side of Love and Feeling with that piece of crap song. And Phil Spector gets his reports every day, you know, his DJ reports. And he went berserk.
You've Lost That Love and Feeling was maybe still is the single most played track in the history of radio. Is that correct?
I think so.
I think it was at one point, or maybe still is.
And I think one of the... I think a Beatles song might have overtaken it. I forget.
It's basically my dad's favorite of all time. Yeah, is the Righteous Brothers. I grew up on the Righteous Brothers' greatest hits.
Yeah, my dad is a singer and has sang that a million times and always sings the high bit. He's the tenor.
Well, Phil Spector had them for a very short time, had the Righteous Brothers.
Yeah, like a year and a half.
And then they went to MGM. And I got a call one day to go record for them, and I'll be there in a heartbeat. And Phil got really pissed off at me. Because I was going to work for the Righteous, but I said, Phil, this is my job. I said, this is how I support my family. This is what I do, you know. He said, well, why are you working for them? You know, I said, Phil, I'm not working for them. I'm working for MGM. That's who I'm working for. And we didn't talk for 13 years after that.
Was it really that long?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, he's not giving you like a retainer or anything. You know?
No.
Right. And so the next time you worked with him was
way later.
77. Death of a Ladies Man, Leonard Cohen.
Yes, that was it.
Okay. Sounds like you missed a lot of the years that were some real prime craziness.
Yeah.
And, you know, everybody has, not everybody, but most people that will ask me, was he shooting off guns when you were there? I never saw a gun one time.
Well, he had that whole crazy period with Lennon where he was hanging out with John Lennon.
Oh, yeah, sure. And evidently he shot the guns off I wasn't there, so I can't be absolutely accurate.
But during the Ramones sessions, you were on those sessions, right?
I don't know. I think I might have played one or two. They weren't there, though.
Okay. Uh-huh. Okay.
Right.
But I did work for one of the Ramones who was producing, what's her name? One of the singers that used to work for, I can't remember her name right now, but he wanted to produce her, and then I worked for, Steve Douglas had put it together, the saxophone player. Right. With one of the girls that was a background singer, but she's Jeannie King. She should have been out there on her own, actually. She's another great voice.
So Joe and I are crazy Lee Hazlewood fans. I mean, we know all the records. I mean, every single one. You know, what
so you
was
kind
that
of, you were there
like?
Pretty much on almost all those.
110 albums.
Yeah.
You met him on Boots, right?
Yep.
And you met Nancy on Boots. That was a great goddamn day.
Oh, yeah, sure. LHI.
Yeah, yeah. And then you wound up doing like serious pieces of art like Some Velvet Morning.
That's my favorite one of all the songs. You
and
know, I
Arkansas
love Boots.
Cole Sweet.
Oh, gee. Oh, that's amazing. You know who wrote that?
Who?
You don't know.
I'm not offhand.
Dolly Parton, I think.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
I think she
yeah,
wrote
that. You can hear that. Yeah, you can hear it's kind of in her voice.
And Nancy, it's a tough song to sing.
Yeah.
Very hard song to sing. I think another pianist who became arranger later on, Larry Mahobrek. Larry did a bunch of stuff.
That's like their prog song. It's all over the place. Yeah. It's like a movie.
Yeah, it's great.
I think for anybody who's like an offspring of a very famous parent, Nancy pretty much had the coolest career of any.
You know, she Bono has a song called Two Shots. Mm-hmm. And Frank should have sung it. You know, he did a version of it.
Right.
But Nancy's version of it is incredible. And I still don't know if she's released that on anything. But we used to do it on stage. Mm-hmm. And we did, one year we did the Jerry Lewis telethon right after Frank had passed away. And it was up there.
I worked with Jerry.
And I had we did it in rehearsal, and then I had to run home that night and write a big band chart because all my friends were in it.
Right.
So we did it the next day, and she raised when that was on. But it was Nancy was the hardest song she ever had to sing for that charity. And not only that, there's her father all over picture, and she's trying to sing that song. I don't know how she made it through. It was so tough. But she raised a fortune for his charity at that point.
Mm-hmm. I'll tell you, there's a real interesting tension between the two in terms of what they seem to want out of life, because Nancy is a born pop star, but he seems way more interested in kind of existing on the periphery. Like his album titles, his liner notes.
He has sort of a self-deprecating kind of persona.
Yeah.
He being Lee.
Yes. Lee, yeah. Which is very intriguing.
But he also, you know what I always admired in Lee? If it was a good song, that's all that mattered, whether he wrote it or not. Mm-hmm. He would take somebody else's song. He did Son of Hickory Holler's Tramp. We did it with, I can't remember, the country artist that he had, a guy from Arizona, and we got number one record with it. The next week, right after we had recorded that, I did the same song again with O.C. Smith for Jerry Fuller, and he got a number one record out of it. So there were a period of a week to 10 days, I did both of them. I arranged the first one. Oh, I almost had his name. Real great, great country singer. But with Lee, Lee had a wonderful way of recognizing that a song is good. Mm-hmm. That's a true A&R man. Jimmy Bowen was another guy like that.
Yeah, Lee seemed like he was like a real big picture guy. Like he could see what the record was going to be like. He's thinking of it in those terms.
He also was a cheap son of a bitch.
Yeah, it seems like he's got some quirks to his personality.
I had a fight with him over every band. What was his name? Harper. He had this wonderful artist we did.
Who grew that mustache first? Was it you or him?
No, him. Lee had a mustache. But I'm trying to remember this kid who had a stuttering problem. But when he sang just so beautifully.
Not Jerry Reed.
No.
Jerry Reed sang.
I know who you're talking about.
It's on Lee's
Mel
label.
Tillis?
Mel Tillis. Something not Jerry Reed. Jerry Reed did not stutter. I was
it's
thinking
something
of Mel Tillis.
With Lee in it. Not Harper Lee. I can't remember. If I had the list in front of me, I'd recognize it. But he had another guy, Wayne. Something Wayne something, who was Glenn Campbell before Glenn Campbell. Mm-hmm. It just never happened. A bunch of the things that on that label, I always thought a bit of it was, okay, let's go in and cut this. And I think some of that was part of his business, so mm-hmm. that if it didn't happen, he could write it off. You know,
he's another example of an artist. I think him and you know, the records he made with Nancy, where those kind of got reappreciated by people our age.
And then he wound up working with other female singers, who were fantastic, like Susie Jane Holcomb. You know the Cowboy in Sweden record?
Oh, absolutely.
We love that record.
What about a song? What if I gave a little war and nobody came? Did you ever hear that song? That's Susie Jane? Oh, it's wonderful. Yeah. Nice trumpet parts in that one that I wrote for her.
Yeah, I love all the side projects he did with all the girl groups and all the LHI stuff is fantastic.
And Lee, as a big a hillbilly he was, he loved jazz. He loved all kinds of music. I shouldn't say just jazz, but he liked to come to jazz clubs all the time. He would always come to see us wherever we played, so that was kind of neat on his part. And so did Nancy, for that matter.
Yeah.
But
Was Frank jealous of your relationship and closeness with Nancy?
Not at all. Are you kidding? Frank's father, Nancy's father, and I got along great.
That's good.
Yeah, I mean, there's some great stories in my book about it, but he respected it. You know, I turned down that job. I could have had that job. It was given up twice by two different piano players that were with him.
You got to remember Frank's. You know, he's like a pro. You know, he's like a musician too. He speaks the same language. You know.
But you didn't want that kind of stress.
We had an incredible drummer that traveled. We were opening for Frank, and his name was Bobby Economo. One of the best. He was with Blood, Sweat, and Tears. A couple of other bands, but he was with my band for a couple of years. And you talk about when you're a pianist, you don't want to have to wonder where the time is ever. So that if you want to change the time, you can, and you know what's going to go with you. You don't have to worry about it. Bobby Economo is that. Man, he is so solid. We call deep pockets. Mm-hmm. He'll go as deep or as on edge as you want, mm-hmm. and he knows when to do it. But we were all in tuxedos, you know, all that, except for Irv Cutler, who is Frank Sinatra's drummer, would always have these wonderful, beautiful patent leather shoes on. And you know, that was Frank's drummer. We all adored Irv. He was such a wonderful guy. But Bobby Economo had a tuxedo on and these dirty sneakers that he would put on right before he would go up to the drums because he didn't want the drums flying all. He was a hard hitter, you know. And Frank would stand there and look at him and look down and just shake his head. What the fuck?
So would a gig like that have been like unnecessary, have someone unnecessarily breathing down your neck?
No.
Is that why you turned it down? Or
no, I'll tell you exactly why I turned it down. I was making more money than 10 guys in his band for just playing piano for Nancy. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Enough said. Frank, right. Frank paid well, but not like what Nancy paid. Not like what Elvis paid. Not
right,
what it,
right.
But when you worked for Frank, it was prestige, you know, so yeah. You had to look at it that way.
Right.
Plus, if you're out on the road, it's kind of the same thing these days. If you have to kind of weigh whether you're going to want to do a tour, if you're doing a lot of dates, you know, if you're
sure.
doing a lot of sessions.
Yeah. Like, you know, people, fortunately, I have, my family is very large, and I have kids, lots of kids around, so I get to hear what's happening today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Not yesterday, but
right,
what's
right.
happening right now
right.
most of the time. And it keeps me going so that if somebody said, can you do something like the band Tool, I would know what they were talking
right.
about.
Yeah.
You know?
I hope never. I hope no one ever asks you that.
I hope they do.
that
happens to be one of my favorite bands.
Really?
I love that band. I think Danny Carey.
Yeah, I know Danny.
Danny is one of the most underestimated drummers yeah. around. You know, he's
Speaking
incredible.
Of drummers.
Those were the first guys I kind of knew when I came to L.A. were the guys from Tool.
I didn't know you knew them.
Because I played in Lusk.
Yes, I know.
Joe,
so
you know how they have a room just a little bigger than this room is, and the one wall, because none of them read,
mm-hmm.
is blackboard.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how they do it. And if something's not right, they can erase. I think it's fucking brilliant. Okay, let's, and then I'm re-
so
I love it.
I'm curious, you know, because this is someone I've actually done a bunch of research on. Jim Gordon, the session drummer. I'm just curious if you had felt that he had that kind of dark energy in him at the time.
It never was dark. Was dark. He had powerful energy, and he was wonderful to play with.
He's an incredible drummer.
And a groove player, too. And another guy that could play anything mm-hmm. with ease.
Yeah.
And he always got a nice sound out of his drums. He was so easy to play with, and playing live with him was so much fun, you know, to play in a club with him because he could express himself.
Yeah, so he played at the Baked Potato.
He did, sure.
Yeah.
Tell us about one of the stories I loved in your book. It was the story about Dale Evans, the session with Dale
Oh, my
Evans.
God.
And I bet you can tell it better in person than it is in the book.
Well.
I really empathize with you in that session because I've been in that exact position.
The rhythm section was, it was the Anita Kerr, was the arranger and choral director. And she had 8 or 10 of the greatest voices you could ever hear. All the top studio people in Los Angeles, the best. This was the best of the best. And she had written beautiful vocalese for Dale Evans. And Dale Evans wrote a song called Jesus is Coming. I know he is coming. Jesus is coming someday.
For those of you who don't know who Dale Evans is, she's sort of a country, like very wholesome Roy Rogers'
wife.
wife, right? So she's like, you know, very, very famous.
Very famous. and delightful person.
Right.
The rhythm section was just Earl Palmer on drums, Carol Kay on bass, and myself playing piano.
Can't beat that.
It was at Capitol, actually, Capitol A, where we were doing this. And we had already done a couple of sides, and now this one came up. And Anita Kerr turns to Earl and Carol, says, you know, I think I just like Don on this alone. It calls for that. So I sit down and I'm looking. There is not a seventh or a flat five. Everything is white chords, as
no
I
chords
prefer
with
them.
Numbers.
No. I mean, everything is so, you know, it's what it is. It's not gospel music, but it's church. And Dale Evans, has a vibrato in her voice when she holds long notes that you can row a boat through. And here we are, we're listening, and we start doing it, and he's coming, and I'm looking at all these singers who are right just opposite me, and they're just, and it's sharp, and it's flat, and they're singing like they're doing the greatest symphony, and I'm thinking to myself, they gotta know how fucking bad she sounds, and they go straight ahead, and we stop, and Anita stops, she's just, let's start again, we start again. And now we do it a second time. We get about a third of the way through. She stops. She's conducting. She stops. She says, let's start again. We do this about 5 or 6 times. And I'm looking over at these singers who are totally ignoring her because they must know.
It's going to be hard to sing with that going on.
They're hearing what I'm hearing in my earphones. And now it starts to strike me funny. And I start, and now Earl is behind the window of the studio. He's looking out, and he sees me, and he goes like this. He puts his finger and goes, "Don't do it," you know. And which was worse. And I'm playing. I'm finally about the 11th take. God knows what it is. I can't take it anymore. And she hits a note that is not on this earth, and I lose it, and I just, I just cracks me up. And Anita Kerr turns around and looks at me. She's staring at me. She wanted to kill me. And they're all so quiet, like they're totally ignoring. And I can't stop laughing. She says, I'll finish this myself. So I got up and I walked out of the studio and I couldn't stop. So her husband was the contractor. And he's yelling at me and threatening me. I said, don't threaten me. And Earl walks over and says, you can't do that. Not then. And they had to pay me for the dates anyway. But she kicked me off the date. But that's an absolutely true story.
I want to talk to you about your club because you have a legendary club. And I'm curious. It's called The Baked Potato. It's been going on. It's been open and running now for 51 years. And I'm curious how you continue to run a club like this, and also how you found time to open one during an era when you were, you know, going to sessions constantly.
Well, I'll tell you one of the main reasons I did it. I worked for a guy from 1957 to 1969. His name was Pat Dennisant, and he had a club called Sherry's, which is a famous little jazz trio club that Hampton Hawes used to play at, Pete Jolly played at. And I would get the off night, and the off night I got was when Marty Paich didn't want to play there anymore with the great bass player Joe Mondragon. It was a duo. A guy heard me playing down on 6th Street and said, the club owner, Pat, said, come up and you can work Sunday nights because I know you're not working for Marianne then. So I came up and we started playing on Sunday nights with a duo, and I hated it. So I said, I have to have drums. So I was the first one to bring a drum in that little club. And I stayed there, and I just loved playing there, playing live. But when 63 and 64 started, I was hardly there. So Leon Russell was my substitute piano player. Mike Melvoin was my substitute piano player. Bruce Johnston of the Beach Boys was my... So all these guys were filling in for me all the time. And finally, the club owner, who was like a second father to me, Pat says, listen, you little he-bastard, you know. He says, don't pull that shit with me. He says, one day you're going to get your own place, and then you'll aggravate the shit out of yourself.
was he prescient in making that comment?
Well, Pat was like, he was like a second father to me, very close. I get choked up every time I talk about him. He was a great guy. I mean, he should have been a movie star. That's how good looking he was. He was like John Payne, if you can imagine. And he was connected. What can I tell you? I worked for him for 13 years. I never had to buy clothes. He would always send me, go here. And he was that kind of guy. He was great. And his son, Gino, who just recently passed away, was very close to me also. But because of that whole time that we were there, I'm losing my train of thought, I got to meet so many great people and meet other piano players and stay busy, but I always enjoyed the live audience, to have somebody respond to something you played or somebody not to respond, which is a thing that I'm trying to teach. Well, I'll go do a seminar. And the thing for all of us that have the gift of being able to entertain somebody and maybe bring enjoyment to them. And some nights you'll be playing with a band, and the band is the most cohesive thing, and you're sitting there, and man, you're burning. Everything goes where everything's supposed to go without you having to say anything, without you having to think. And then the audience is there, and you finish a tune, and it's...
Yeah.
And then the other nights, you want to kill everybody on the bandstand because nothing is cohesive, and you're fighting, and everybody... And the audience is loving it, and they're applauding like you're the biggest star. How do you explain that?
Yeah, I got to say, I miss playing in front of audiences. You know, I kind of sort of semi-retired from touring when we had our little one, and then the pandemic happened, And I'm kind of really missing the thing of getting that instant response, you know. Still making a lot of music, but...
We will definitely get to, when we talk about Axl Rod, we'll get to your greatest gig ever, the Electric Prunes.
The potato is blessed with such a great location. Yeah. The location's really wonderful. It's right. It's in the perfect part of town.
It was a little print shop. Mm-hmm. And I was very good friends with Carmen Maselli. I've been friends with him since 1954 till he passed away, and I know all his sons. Carmen's Maselli's had four or five places in Los Angeles at one point. And Carmen was a big jazz lover. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, the one in Hollywood, he still has they still play duo jazz up there, mm-hmm. at the one in Hollywood on Las Palmas. And I think they still do out a little bit at the one not far from the Baked Potato, they play opera. Mm-hmm. It's like classic opera that all the waiters and waitresses sing. But Carmen Maselli was the one. He says, there's, you know, a couple of places down from my other place. And that's where we came. Mm-hmm. And there was nothing there. And we didn't have a liquor license. We opened with beer and wine. And mm-hmm. Mike Melvoin, a great pianist, mm-hmm. a great guy too, he worked one night a week for 2 or 3 years and had a different rhythm section, a different bass player, a different guitar player, or a different drummer. Every week, I think he might have repeated 2 or 3 times, mm-hmm. but you name him, fame or not famous, they played with him on that off night.
Well, in the history of that venue, the sheer, it must be staggering, everyone who's played there over the years.
And that was a Steinway B that mm-hmm. we had in that club, so it was a really good piano, mm-hmm. and everybody wanted to play it, and we had it was tuned every two, three times a week, mm-hmm. sometimes. And Keith Albright, the master tuner, took care of us mm-hmm. till we stopped using the... I was the only one using the Steinway. Right. Everybody went to electronic keyboards. Mm-hmm. Even the Steinway was MIDI'd. Right. I had that Forte MIDI mod put in it. Uh-huh. It sounded pretty good, actually. Uh-huh. But that club, and to maintain a jazz club in this city, got to remember, Dante's was open at that. There was 4 places in Studio City that had jazz.
Right.
But it was great. There was enough for everybody.
Right.
You could make the rounds. Mm-hmm. They were called rounders, people that would, you know, okay, let's hit this
the
place.
The potato has outlasted them all.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes,
it's impressive, especially given how busy you were. I mean, when you set it up, and you know, it's stunning and staggering that you've been able to keep it up.
Shelly Mann called me. You know, he had that club for years. About 6 months after we were in it, he says, Don, are you out of your fucking mind? Just like that. I said, why? He says, good luck. He says, you better watch your receipts every night. Whoever was there was supposed to be a friend of his and was killing him for 10 years. Mm-hmm. And he could never figure it out because he was too busy in his studio, you know.
Yeah.
Michael Brecker called me from New York. They had that club, the Brecker Brothers in New York. Mm-hmm. And he says, Don, what the hell is going on? He says, well, what should I do? You want to make it into a baked potato? I said, I don't know. He says, I don't know what to do with the waitresses, the bartenders. I said, can I ask you a question? What kind of car is your bartender driving? And that was it. Mm-hmm. He was killing him.
Right.
That was it. And I wasn't even there. I just had a feeling that if you can't, you know, you have to have reliable people if you're going to have a business like that because it's very easy for everything to disappear.
Yeah,
and it's not an easy business as it is to make a living.
Seems like jazz is kind of on the upswing in L.A. the last like 10 years or so. It seems like it's kind of moved here again.
Well, it's not so much. I remember we were just talking about this the other day about when you took a girl out and you were like 18 or 17, and you said you were a musician, and they wanted to know what's your real job, you know, or what else do you do.
I get that a lot still.
You know, to this day, we're very fortunate. I have been very fortunate to be in the right place many times at the right time and to be able to get to do all that stuff that I did. I mean, it's wonderful. And at the same time, it was some of the worst music I ever played was on some of those dates, but also some of the greatest music mm-hmm. I got to play on. You know,
you're just stretching out. Right, yeah, I mean, this is where you get to...
And you don't really know what if I knew what every time I walked in the studio, what it was going to be a hit, you know, I'd be wealthy. You know, you could do anything you wanted, but you can't do that. You don't know. And I always like to say people listen with their eyes. Mm-hmm. You know, many, many times that's the occasion. They could care less if it's the old Elvis or the new Elvis, you know, the young Elvis or the old Elvis. Mm-hmm. You know? And... And fortunately, Elvis reached all those people. The old audience will never leave him. Mm-hmm. And now some of the younger ones, when they see and find out about it, they might cotton on to it also. The 1968 comeback special.
Yeah.
That's me playing piano through that whole thing.
Right, that's unbelievable.
I am proud of that. I mean, that's been a great thing I got to play on, you know.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it must be a good feeling that almost all of the music that you made will go on generation after generation, and you'll still be around, you know, hopefully forever because of that.
And for me, I've always admired celebrity. I can't get away from it. I mean, to me, standing having a conversation just like you and I are having right now with Elvis, mm-hmm. or with Frank, or with Bobby Darin, or with Jimmy Darin, or you know, to be at that close proximity.
Well, and, you know, and you're meeting them on your own terms. Which is the great thing. That I've experienced a little bit of that. You know, you're not just a random person on the street. You're there for a reason.
Yes, it's nice. It's a nice feeling. Yeah. It really is. And I think. Not that we're searching for respect, but it's like a given between the people that are attending that situation. You know, you can really feel it, and when you do, it's nice.
It helps to have their respect because what you bring to their world is enormous.
Well, that's true many times, and what they're bringing to my world is enormous too.
Sure. I mean, my background and my connection to L.A. in the music business is not too different from yours. I came out here with nothing but my ability to play. I didn't have any connections or like any, you know, I just was able to help people, you know, and get into situations and make people sound good, and I made a life out of that sort of, you know.
Yeah.
So it is satisfying in that respect. You know, it's like you kind of did it. You know, you did it with just your hands.
Yes. Yeah.
And listen, built it from nothing in this.
In 1954, when I came out here, not far from where we are right today, I had a tack hammer, one of those hammers. That's what I was digging ditches in East LA in Boyle Heights, so I could go to school and get to.
I didn't have a ditch digging phase.
Yeah, you name it, I did it from 54 to 56. I sold candy on the highway in San Pedro. Right near where the glass church is on Pacific Coast Highway, where the marine land of the Pacific used to be there. That was my spot. I sold peanut brittle, butter toffee, cashews, fudge. And the candy that I sold was made the day before it was on the highway. It was so fresh. So that's how I put myself through school.
You also have that sort of thing to your legacy of just like the baked potato that contributed to like the history of Los Angeles. You know, it's an institution of Los Angeles. That must be something you're very proud of.
Oh,
it's an institution in a great city.
It is. And we outlasted a lot of places. You never had to pay to play in our club.
Right.
You know, you always, I don't care what if it was, $25 or whatever it was that you made.
Everybody has very fond opinions and feelings about the venue. And
it's wild.
Yeah.
Well, we appreciate everything you've brought to music. In a way that it probably comes off a little bit fanboyish, but we're incredibly enthusiastic about all your work, and we just want to, you know, convey our appreciation and thank you for coming on for the interview.
Sure, absolutely.
All right, that just about does it. Thanks for joining us. A heartfelt Discography thanks goes out to our graphic designer, Todd Zimmer, my beautiful wife and son, Jen and Mason, Don Randy, Joe Kennedy, Corbin Betleon, and the entire Patreon community. I love you, and frankly, this show would not exist without you. And be sure to stay tuned, because this Tuesday brings upon us another incredible episode of Discography's The Private Press with Paul Major, wherein you'll be introduced to a whole new world of music there's very little chance you've either heard or heard of before, not to mention this Thursday's wildcard episode as well. Of course, you'll also want to tune in a week from today for Andrew Tuttle raiding the Monks, right here in the place to which I've decided to spend the rest of my life, prattling on and on into this silly little microphone, into your ear holes, so we can rock on collectively in the manner in which we've become accustomed. Stay gold, motherfuckers. It's Discography.